Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. On today's show, Pershing Square gets a makeover, and an author responds to ghoulish LED lights. First, though, to Sixth Street Bridge. We're at a party to mark a big transition that is taking place at this bridge. It's one of the most iconic of the bridges that cross the LA River. It connects Boyle Heights to downtown Los Angeles. It was built in 1932. It was designed by an engineer named Merrill Butler. But the bridge has some structural problems and it has to be torn down. It's going to be replaced by an exciting new bridge by the architect Michael Moltzen. You'll hear from him in a moment. But before we get to that, we talked to a few people on the bridge to just get a sense of how they feel about it.
What's up, y'all? This is Ultramagnetic Taboo, and I am here, 6th Street Bridge. For us as Angelenos, it's a very monumental spot. Driving through here, going to practice, picking up Will.i.am when we would go and rehearse when we were first starting the Black Eyed Peas. It's a great thing for me to be part of this because I am Los Angeles representative every day, all day.
My name is Beatriz Ochoa. I grew up in Boyle Heights, not too far from the 6th Street Bridge. And I remember as a kid driving through and we were allowed to be in the back of the truck that my dad used to own, a Ford truck. And my sister and I would lay back and we would cross the bridge. And I would always remember this bridge because of the lights and, of course, the iconic arches that you see. And so we knew we were close to home when we would cross the bridge.
I used to ride my bike across this bridge practically every day for about 2.5 years. I grew up in Boyle Heights on the east side. Would ride my bike over to downtown LA, go to printing presses at the Rafu Shimpu, which is a Japanese newspaper, come back loaded with my newspapers and deliver them and the largest last remaining community of Japanese Americans in the country. And I had many memories across this bridge, some good, some bad. You know, I would love to come over early afternoon and take in the breathtaking views. Sometimes I come back late because the presses started late and have to drive across this bridge in the darkness and almost swerving, trying to avoid cars. And that's what really established for me, I think, my thought about what we have to do with the new design.
This is Councilman Jose Huizar. He grew up in Boyle Heights, and so the bridge means an enormous amount to him personally. Now it's in his district, and he's overseeing the transition.
Which is to create protected bike lanes, protected areas for pedestrians to enjoy the bridge. I believe strongly that not only on this bridge, but the rest of Los Angeles, that we need to prioritize pedestrians and bicycles just as much as we have been prioritizing cars for a very long time. And we no longer have to just measure our success in transportation about how quickly we could get a car through, but how safe pedestrians, bicycles, and cars are, and if we could all get through, period.
That was Councilman Jose Huizar sharing his thoughts on the 6th Street Bridge as Angeleno said goodbye to it this past weekend. But what's going to replace the 3,500-feet-long classic modern bridge with its memorable steel arches? We ran into Gary Lee Moore. He's the Los Angeles City Engineer.
It's going to be what we call a ribbon of arches. It'll be 10 pairs of arches, and they'll range in height. It reflects the past, but it looks towards the future. It's so, we're adding bike lanes on each side of the bridge. There's going to be wider sidewalks, double the width on the sidewalks. So it's really going to be what we call a multimodal. And one of my favorite parts about it is this four-level helical bike ramp that we're going to have on the east side of the river to bring people from down below 50 to 70 feet up to the bridge level. So, I mean, it's really going to be a place and a destination.
And the current bridge is being taken down because of some structural deficiencies. What is the new bridge going to be made of?
Well, The existing bridge has alkali silica reaction, and it's a concrete cancer. When they built this bridge, they didn't do the rigorous testing we now do of concrete. So the new bridge will be built of concrete, but the testing, we won't have alkali silica reaction anymore. It'll be here for 100 plus years.
The designers of the new bridge are LA architect Michael Moltzen and engineering firm HNTB. We ran into Michael at the party Saturday and asked him, is this event overwhelming, since he is the guy responsible for replacing a local icon?
It is, certainly, and to be here on the bridge with this many people. In a lot of ways, what's going on this afternoon is exactly what we're hoping will happen in the future with the new 6th Street Bridge.
Which is people walking across the bridge.
People walking, cycling, celebrating, being a part of the city. When you're up on the bridge right now, one of the fantastic things is the way that you can see the surrounding city and feel like you're both at an event, but also very much in the middle of the city at the same time.
Are you going to provide bands?
That's right. I promise I'll make a playlist. That'll be a part of our job.
And what would be the music to go with your 6th Street Bridge?
That's a very good one. I think probably the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Whoa, interesting. So, Michael, tell us a bit about the new bridge.
We're envisioning this bridge as taking on a greater responsibility of doing more as infrastructure in the city. And that means connecting not only from point A to point B, but becoming a destination that connects the flats underneath, makes the river that much more accessibility, ties together communities, and becomes a destination for celebration.
And has some real architectural stamp. The current bridge is described as an icon. You know, people do love its arches. It does have a certain visual drama. That's definitely an important piece for you.
It's really, in a lot of ways, a fundamental part of the responsibility of this bridge to try to make a bridge which is at least equivalent to the icon that the existing 6th Street Bridge is. It has been a background for films, TV shows, any number of car commercials. It is really a set piece for the city. And what we've tried to do is connect to some of the energy of the existing 6th Street Bridge and extend that, hopefully making a bridge that has as much spirit, as much life and liveliness as the current bridge does. And if we're successful, it'll continue to be really that backdrop for what represents the best and most creative in the city.
That was Michael Moltzen, architect of the replacement 6th Street Viaduct. The $428 million bridge is expected to open in 2019. For one person at the party, the goodbye was most definitely bittersweet.
I'm Merrill Butler III. I'm the grandson of Merrill Butler Sr., who was the designer and builder of all the iconic bridges over the LA River.
So you're the connection to the past here. Did he express feelings about this bridge, or once built, did he not talk about it?
You know, he was a very humble person, and so he acted as if the bridges that he created, well, this was just all part of his job.
Based on how you've described your grandfather, presumably he might be a little surprised by the big party here today.
Oh, he would be totally surprised. I am going to get down on my knees tonight and say, okay, Baba, as I called him, let me tell you what happened today. And I'm sure he's going to listen and go, what in the world is wrong with those people? It's just a bridge.
That was Merrill Butler III, grandson of Merrill Butler I, the designer of the iconic 6th Street Bridge over the LA River. Do you have memories of the bridge? Share them with us on our Facebook page or email us at dna@kcrw.org. Now from the 6th Street Bridge to another LA landmark on the brink of an overhaul. Pershing Square is in the middle of downtown LA, and over the past 1.5 centuries, it's undergone many iterations. The most recent redesign was completed in the early 90s by Mexican architect Ricardo Legarreta. It features a 10-story purple bell tower, fountains, a concert stage, and small plazas with seating. But it is not a beloved park. Wade Graham has been thinking quite a bit about just why not. He's a landscape designer and author of the forthcoming book, Dream Cities, Seven Urban Ideas That Shape the World. We met him at Pershing Square.
Well, standing inside the park, and this is everyone's classic experience of Pershing Square, you look at these sort of walls and these the odd tower and the strange large spheres and the kind of festival colors, and you're looking at a Ricardo Legarreta copying his own work from Mexico City, and it makes no sense whatsoever. It's kind of interesting looking, but it doesn't make any sense. Other than that, what's really wrong with this park is that it's disconnected from the city grid. It's disconnected from the sidewalks. It's disconnected from the streets that go around it. There are walls all the way around it. There are on-ramps, exit ramps and in-ramps and ramps of various kinds all around it to get cars in and out of the garage. Fast traffic. There's no connection when you're on the sidewalk. You look in and you can't see into the park because there's a kind of a maze of walls. When you're inside the park, you're in the maze of walls. It feels unsafe. You don't have a perspective. You can't see the sidewalk, and they can't see you. So it's essentially been dissociated from the life of the city, and it creates a problematic space. I wouldn't blame Legarreta for the design. I think the design isn't problematic once you're inside the park. He's mimicking an urban plaza in a Latin country that is hard, has a few trees, mostly hard surfaces, some changes in level, some interesting work. The problem is, that lovely design can't overcome the fact that the park has been ripped out of the heart of the city and walled off from it.
And when you say it's been ripped out of the heart of the city, was there a time where it was the heart of the city, or at least it was embedded into the heart of the city? And what was it like, and when was that?
I think it probably was the heart of the city. It was the second park set aside in the 19th century, in the American period, 1866, but it was called La Plaza Baja, the lower plaza, because the upper plaza being up at the Pueblo, across the freeway now. And this was really the heart of town. This is really the intersection between the different business districts and the et cetera, and a lot of residential. Right behind me was Bunker Hill, still is Bunker Hill, but there were about 40,000 people that lived in this area, and they lived in mixed housing. They were ethnically mixed. They were economically mixed. It was a vibrant part of downtown. It looked a lot like Victorian San Francisco. And by mid-century, what happened in Los Angeles, as happened in most American cities, was the forces that wanted to decentralize were able to create a narrative called blight, that inner cities, because they had mixed housing and mixed income and mixed races and people living near work, were somehow blighted and irrecoverable, and it was a medical condition that had to be treated with knives, and the knives were the bulldozers of urban renewal. So those people were evicted, the buildings were knocked down. Pershing Square was once a park for almost 100 years, and then they decided to put a parking structure underneath it, which was done in 1951. The park torn out, the concrete put in, and then something like a park put back in, and it's never worked since.
That was Wade Graham, landscape designer and teacher at Pepperdine University. So a group of local business people, community leaders, and the architecture firm Gensler got together and created a group called Pershing Square Renew, helmed by Councilman Jose Huizar. They secured $1 million from the Department of Recreation and Parks for immediate improvements and another $1 million in seed capital from neighbouring McFarlane Partners for future improvements. So what was Pershing Square Renew's vision for the square? We asked Councilman Huizar when we met him at the 6th Street Bridge.
You know, Pershing Square, as it sits now, it has experienced several redesigns. And the last one that we experienced was in the 90s, when it was designed in such a way that many of the buildings of its time were designed, and that is with a fortress-type mentality. It was, how do we keep elements out? And that was because downtown was a ghost town at that time. And so now, with the new Los Angeles, where we're building a city within a city, where 10 years ago we had 10,000 people who lived there, and now we have 55,000 and growing, and more visitors, and it's becoming more of an entertainment destination point for people throughout the world, we ask ourselves, well, why not redesign the Pershing Square for the new Los Angeles? And so we were very happy to see that when we put our a request for interest from design firms from throughout the world, we had about 80 responses. We've now, and when we opened it up for them to actually apply, about 50 firms applied, and that is huge. There's a lot of interest. And I'm not trying to guide the new design, but the only thing that my little two cents of input is to say that we want it to be more open and flow well with the local outside of Pershing Square, and not have our vistas blocked by parking garage entrances, and we needed to be an open area. So that's what we're hoping to have.
And you just mentioned the entrances to the parking, which are the big obstruction. And You know, there's people are definitely asking, can one just get rid of the parking garage? Is that even a possibility?
It's a possibility, although Rec and Parks has made it clear to us that, you know, it's a huge revenue generator for them. And something that I look at downtown LA right now, and we shouldn't design, we could design things in such a way. Let's think about the use first and then design things. For the longest times, we've been thinking about, well, you know, there's homeless here, and so we can't design this how we would like to. Let's keep them out and obstruct things. And I think that's how this park was designed in the past. I'd love to see something where, if possible, we could keep the garage because we're going to need revenue for the park, but at the same time, not have it be an obstruction. And you see it. You see projects throughout the world that are designed in such a way where both cars and people and coexist, and that's what we're looking for.
That was Councilman Jose Huizar. Today, Pershing Square Renew announced 10 finalists who'll go forward and develop what they're calling a vision narrative for Pershing Square. The list of 10 design teams includes some big names. Locally, we've got Rios Clemente Hale, who designed Grand Park. They're teamed up with Rem Koolhaas's firm, Omar from New York, or OMA. We've got Mia Lehrer Associates, Peter Walker, another well-known landscape architect from San Francisco. We've got Morphosis Architects, they designed Caltrans and many other buildings. They're teamed up with SWA. We've got James Corner Field Operations. James Corner famously designed the High Line in New York. He's teamed up with LA's Frederick Fisher. That's just some of the names. Eduardo Santana is executive director of Pershing Square Renew, and we asked him, what are they expecting from these teams?
Their challenge is not to win awards with their redesign, but to really win the hearts of Los Angeles. And, you know, this may be difficult for some of them because all too often designers, you know, get concerned about the evaluation of their peers. But in this instance, we need them to really be supremely interested in the experiences their design inspires and the memories the space creates. And so we've been engaged in a year and a half of public outreach and have talked to thousands of people from throughout Southern California. And I've really been interested in what are the programs, activities, and uses that you would love to see at Pershing Square? What are the memories that you want to create here? And we're really looking for a team that's going to deliver a design solution that provides those great experiences for the Los Angeles public. And it's going to be very interesting in December when they come to present to our jury and to the public some of their ideas and how their teams are going to come together to really wow all of us. Our goal is to be on everyone's like top five list of favorite destinations in Southern California. And so that's what we have our eyes set on. And we're looking for a partner that's going to take on that challenge and going to take on that same goal.
Eduardo Santana is executive director of Pershing Square Renew. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. The Department of Rec and Parks owns the park and the parking below, but now private money is flowing in. So what does it mean for the park? Does it become what planners are calling a privately owned public space? A bit like the water court at California Plaza or the Broad Plaza at the newly opened Broad Museum on Grand Avenue. I asked Brian Glodney, he's design director for planning and urban design at Gensler Los Angeles, which is managing the Pershing Square redesign process.
Pershing Square is not a PUPO. It is publicly owned open space, which is fantastic, which means the city of LA and its citizens have open right to use that space within accordance of law any way they see fit. Which is different than privately owned public open space and the fact that it is private development that the owner, the private developer, is allowing the public to access, which is a key difference.
So, Brian, I'm sure you'll remember when you and I met first time around in Pershing Square, it so happened I was interviewing you and we were asked to stop by a guard who said that one had to get permission to do interviews, even though you and I had agreed upon this interview and we were members of the public that were using our public space. But in fact, it wasn't quite as public as we'd thought. What do you say to those who are already seeing a bit of a trend for these popos? What do you say to those that feel somewhat anxious that somehow the park isn't going to be a fully public space?
I do remember that moment quite well. It was quite an interesting moment, I think, for all of us. It's an interesting question, and I think a lot of it comes down to communication and operations. And as Pershing Square is re-envisioned and a new aspiration comes forth, I believe that will also then come out with communication and operations and management as well. And just as we're approaching Pershing Square in a new way, I have high hopes that the operations, the security, the enforcement will also have high aspirations for a optimistic view of public space.
That was Brian Glodney, urban planner with Gensler. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, LED lighting may be more cost-effective than other types of lighting, but some find it quite ghoulish. And while we're on the topic of ghoulish, we'll hear from the production designer of American Horror Story and find out why the Art Deco style of architecture is spooky.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. In the past few years, cities have begun using LED lights to illuminate their streets. LED stands for light-emitting diodes. Los Angeles did it, so did Seattle, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, and Detroit. But they soon heard from residents who found the color of the light cold and created a harsh glare. One resident who was not happy at all with the LED lighting that sprung up outside her door was the author Lionel Shriver. She lives part of the year in Brooklyn, New York. In a recent New York Times op-ed, she called the LED lights in her neighborhood ugly, invasive, and depressing.
Previously, the sodium bulb, which is just a regular old streetlight bulb that we'd all be familiar with, never called attention to itself. It was, a little orange, had a nice warm glow to it. And then overnight, it gets replaced by an LED. And these bulbs are blaring. They are fantastically bright, many times brighter than the original. The color is very blue. I would have to call it almost ghoulish. It is invasive.
The issue of the quality of the color has become one of the biggest complaints when it comes to LED streetlights, and some residents have fought back. In Berlin, Germany, citizens were so upset that the city had the lights redesigned. And in Davis, California, they ended up changing out the streetlights to be warmer. Meanwhile, just last week, the California Energy Commission proposed new lighting standards. They effectively prohibit sales of small halogen and incandescent bulbs, commonly used in track lighting, in favour of LED lights. So does this mean ghoulishly lit interiors? Not necessarily, say the lighting designers, because the technology is improving so fast. We spoke with Scott Johnson. He's a principal at Brilliant Lighting Studio.
The energy codes have made LEDs, they will be part of our lives from now on, since they're so much greener and more efficient than any of the previous lighting sources.
Is that a good thing in terms of light? We just, as many of us read an op-ed that was in the New York Times this weekend by Lionel Shriver. It was very nicely written, and she got at the emotional impact of light, and she's horrified by the LED light in her neighborhood.
Well, I read that, and I felt a little bad for her and Brooklyn because I suspect that those lights in her street were specified 5 years ago or 6 years ago and made their way through the New York bureaucracy and finally through a long installation process. And unfortunately, with a galloping technology like LEDs, they've gotten something in their neighborhood that is 5 or 6 years old, and in LED years, that's a lifetime. It's too bad. I did notice in that article, because I saw that, that there was a certain nostalgia that she expressed for sodium lighting, which you and I are familiar with is usually inside garages and down city streets. It's a much warmer color temperature. It's a kind of tangerine or pink color, and most people hate it. And to express nostalgia now for it, because cool lighting has been provided on that Brooklyn street, I find a little humorous, frankly, how quickly they forget.
That was Scott Johnson, principal at Brilliant Lighting Studio. You've been listening to DNA. We were talking about LED street lighting. And the author Lionel Shriver didn't like her LED street lighting because she found it ghoulish. But ghoulish is exactly the effect one wants to achieve with lighting in horror films. Think of The Exorcist or A Nightmare on Elm Street. And it's also played to great effect on the new season of American Horror Story. The show also uses architecture to heighten the sense of dread and anxiety. And this season is set in the fictional Hotel Cortez, an Art Deco-inspired hotel in downtown Los Angeles. DNA's producer Avishai Artsy and I visited the set of the hotel the other week.
Well, we went to the Fox Studios lot, actually to interview Mayor Eric Garcetti, who is there giving a press conference on how California film tax credits helped keep American Horror Story filming in L.A. And, you know, he made some jokes about Lady Gaga jumping out from behind a door or something. She's the star of the new season of American Horror Story. She plays a murderous countess. But we were there on set, and, you know, I think both of us found it really striking, this Art Deco-themed hotel lobby with these tall, ornate chandeliers. There's a skylight and this beautiful sloping central staircase. Anyway, I called Mark Worthington, who's the production designer for all the seasons of American Horror Story, and asked him about that choice to set the season in an Art Deco hotel.
Which, of course, one never thought of as particularly scary till now.
Yeah, I wouldn't think of it as a particularly spooky type of design, but he apparently did, and so did the show's founder, Ryan Murphy.
When we start every year with Horror Story, I meet with Ryan Murphy, our showrunner. So he'll describe things to me. He'll sort of give a shape of the world. In this case, he referenced things like the Hotel Cecil, which had a sort of checkered history, and that's a real hotel in downtown LA. And also the Alexandria, which is an old legacy hotel, basically from the 20s. It was a very, very big hotel in the silent era. And then he shows me some research, and then I go away and I do a lot of research and come up with some images. Early on, Art Deco became something that we both were attracted to because it's both extremely glamorous and it speaks to, because our hotel was built in the 20s, it speaks to that era very well. But it's also kind of, it can be very creepy and dark and strange because the imagery in some cases is a bit more modern and streamlined, but it's also somewhat decorative. It's just odd.
One of the most striking features of that lobby is that huge staircase, you know, and you have these kind of grand entrances. And that's actually something that happens in every season, right? There's a staircase in every season.
Staircases are inherently cinematic, and, you know, you can name, you know, thousands of them in every film, Gone with the Wind, or, you know, you can go on and on. But I think there are physical and formal reasons why that's true. I mean, they create a transition from one space to another. That's an obvious one. They're visually dynamic, just inherently, because they imply movement and change and transition. And so they're generally architecturally, strictly from an architectural standpoint, they're usually placed, especially in something like a hotel, at kind of the center of the building. And so they're almost like a sculpture, really.
Yeah.
And Ryan,
and it draws the eyes of the characters in the episode. Like, you think of that scene in Titanic, right, where Rose walks in and Leonardo DiCaprio can't help but look at her because she's walking in on a giant staircase.
Well, and that staircase, similar to ours, it creates these vector lines that draw your eyes specifically to a single point. Our staircase this year does that very much. And so it also, that's a good point, it also creates a sense of focus. I mean, you think of that hotel without that staircase, the hotel's kind of a box. It just is inherently less interesting.
That was production designer Mark Worthington talking to DNA producer Avishai Artsy. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's show. Today's DNA was mixed by JC Swatek. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA and follow us on our Facebook page at kcrwdna. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World coming up next.